Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Richard Price, whose latest novel is Lush Life. Earlier novels include Freedom Land and Clockers. Richard Price has written 5 episodes of The Wire TV show, also screenplays, adaptations for Clockers, Freedom Land, Sea of Love, and other films. Though I understand that that's just kind of work for hire. You are a novelist.
Yeah, I mean, at some point earlier in my life, I always thought, like, wow, this is going to be a movie. At this point, I've been around enough to know I'm going to do the best job I can on a screenplay, and maybe somebody will make the movie.
You're adapting a film of Child 44 for Ridley Scott, is that correct?
Right.
That's set in Russia?
It's historical, 1953. One of the reasons why I took it is because it was so unlike anything that I would naturally gravitate to, and I just sort of wanted to shake things up for myself.
What do you do about dialogue? I mean, for Lush Life, you sat around the Lower East Side for an entire year. How do you deal with dialogue in a movie set in the 50s, then?
Well, I mean, the trick is not to start every sentence with the word comrade. And, you know, the point is to try to just, like, humanize and relax everybody. There's a tendency in historical dramas to make people speak in some kind of stiff, archaic way. And I don't think that's necessary. You know, not everybody was standing at attention all the time. They probably, you know, cursed and muttered and cracked wise, you know, as much as anybody else. And it's just to sort of relax the whole mandate.
Are you going to try to get some idea of, I don't know, a transliteration of Russian slang at all or nothing?
No, no, there's no need for that. I mean, the book is very, very well written and very well researched. The danger in doing independent research on your own is that you wind up like halfway into a forest that, you know, the more you know, the less, sometimes ignorance is confidence.
Does that ever happen when you're writing your novels?
No, I usually stay out in a field, so to speak, way longer than I have to. And I think that's primarily about avoiding writing. You know, I keep thinking I'm going to see something. If I hang out here one more day, that's going to put everything in context. You know, at some point you got to like just shut up and deal.
At what point do you do that? You just finally feel so guilty?
Well, somebody said, who's using that kind of strategy to do a nonfiction book, when you ask someone a question, and in your mind you're saying word for word the answer they're about to say before they say it, you know you've been there too long.
Let's hit The Wire, and then we'll hit Lush Life. You worked on these 5 episodes. Were you part of a writing team, or did David Simon just kind of call you in, give you the basic plot, and you went from there?
Well, it's a little bit of both. They asked me to come on as a writer in the 3rd season. David told me that the starter's yeast for The Wire was Clockers, you know, which I sort of knew. And I watched the show for 2 years with my mouth hanging open. I thought it was, I've never seen anything quite like it. And when he asked me to come on, it was almost like I didn't want to do it because I thought he thought I knew a lot more than I did. I put everything I had in Clockers. I didn't keep anything back. I was almost afraid to be disappointing to them. But, you know, I did come on. And the way it works is at the beginning of the season, you know, they go over, okay, which institution are we going to take apart this year, what's going to happen to our key characters or our key venues, City Hall, Police Department, War on Drugs, what's going to overarchingly happen this year. Then they assign episodes. So if I'm doing episode 3, for example, I'm sent episodes 1 and 2, and then I come into Baltimore and we sit there for a day and a half and make up index cards for every beat in that 60 minutes. It might be 40 beats.
And a beat is a scene?
Yeah, a beat is a scene. Okay, Omar's got 4 beats, 4 little mini scenes. Marlowe and the drug guys, you know, have 5 scenes. McNulty has. And then at the end of the day and a half, he starts taking those index cards off the corkboard in the sequence that he envisions the episode progressing. Mm-hmm. So I go home to New York. I've got a rubber band bound stack of multicolored index cards, and I got to flesh it out, you know, and it's sort of like writing in a phone booth. But, you know, there is a little wiggle room for wit or, you know, personal style. But I can't deviate from that. I can't all of a sudden say, well, you know, I think I'm going to make Omar straight. Because the guy, I'm doing 3, but there's also, you know, Pelicano or Lehane is doing 4. And he's doing 4 predicated on knowing exactly what I'm going to do in 3. So, you know, it's like one of the Rockettes decides to do a pirouette. I mean, you know, they're all going to wind up in the emergency room.
The most amazing part of the episode you did in the final season was a confrontation between the cop McNulty, who's created a phony serial killer and a slimy reporter named Templeton, who has suddenly made a claim that the phony serial killer mm-hmm. has called him. That particular scene, that meeting between the two guys, how much room was there for you?
Well, you know, basically what they say, here's where the scene starts and here's where the scene ends. How you get there from beginning to end is up to you. You know, none of these scenes are more than like 30 seconds, 45 seconds. You know, I can read somebody to riot act if it's an opportunity. I mean, I had Clay Davis, you know, defend himself, and that was kind of juicy, and they let me rip on that.
You also knew that the character was going to say the S word in as many long beats as possible.
Well, yeah, what about 18 E's?
Richard Price, let's talk about your new novel, Lush Life. Set in the Lower East Side, and you decided to move from the fictional town of Dempsey, which is thinly disguised Jersey City, to the Lower East Side. When you did that, is there a housing project similar to the one you described in the Lower East
Side? Yeah, there's a few. Yeah, this is the first time I really located one of my books in a place, because actually the main character in the book is the Lower East Side. So I was more beholden to the real place. That's the whole point of it. Before that, I didn't want to write about Jersey City. I wanted that city to be generic, and the city that's closest to whatever wherever the reader is, Oakland, Richmond, in the case of out here. But this time, it's like the Lower East Side itself said, okay, let's go.
When you're doing something like that and focusing on the Lower East Side or on the projects, let's talk about the projects. Mm-hmm. Is there any difference, let's say, in terms of location between the projects of the Lower East Side and the projects of Dempsey or the projects of Baltimore?
Yeah, there is, and it's a small difference, but usually projects are sort of like shtetls. They're pockets of isolation, and the people in them don't really mix it up with the outside world. But because of the cheek and jowl geography of the Lower East Side, you know, you take 10 steps out of the Smith houses or the Baruch houses, you're in about six universes, you know, of the Lower East Side, which is Chinatown, there's Wall Street, you know. And as a result, those projects are a little less dire than the ones that are in Brooklyn and Queens, for example. They're not as cut off. I mean, you know, there are a lot more outlets. I mean, people know a little bit more about the world outside the projects.
Well, what prompted you to do the Lower East Side at this particular time?
Well, there's 100 reasons, but first of all, I mean, historically, I mean, that place is probably the most important neighborhood in American history.
Well, your grandparents were there, right?
Yeah, but everybody's grandparents sort of
on
the Lower East
Side. Yeah.
You know, unless you're black or something, you know, I mean, every European immigrant, Eastern European immigrant, Catholic or Jewish, even German Protestant, I mean, everybody came to the Lower East Side at the turn of the century, and had the highest population density in the world in 1900, higher than Calcutta. I didn't really want to go back just because my grandparents were there. I don't want to get into that fiddler on the roof stuff. But what happened was, I don't know, about 5 years ago when my daughters were in high school, I realized they knew the Lower East Side better than I did. You know, what places you can get in without getting carded, what were the coolest clothing stores, where you could hear the most cutting-edge music. What they didn't know is that their great-grandfather was maybe 100 feet from where they're licking that gelato, getting put in cuffs in 1915 because he just beat somebody up to steal their money so his mother could pay the rent. I mean, that place was always savage. You know, it gets sentimentalized now, but I mean, it was a real brutal, tough place to live. The irony is that you have these kids, like my kids, and they're the fifth generation descendants of the people that came off the boat, and now they're down there. I don't know if they make the connection that they've just made a full 125-year full circle. So that, in part, was a little bit what got me going. But I didn't write it for them. I didn't know what I was going to see when I got down there. I knew the place had become bohemianized in a high-priced way. Vaguely, I knew something about a huge hidden Chinese population down there. When I got down there, there's like six different universes. There's the Orthodox Jews. There's the world of the housing projects. There's the unrehabbed tenements that the real estate lava hasn't hit yet. And that's Dominican, Puerto Rican, Black, Chinese, geezer, hippie, then you got all these 20-somethings coming down there with their laptops and their tattoos. It's Byzantium.
And it's from Houston down to Delancey?
It goes all the way to Canal. Delancey seems to be where the real estate lava slowed a little bit because it's a double street. And, you know, it'll go further. It'll go further.
Going west, it goes as far as?
Going west, I'd say the Bowery. Technically, what's the Lower East Side? I think it's Bowery on the west, the East River on the east. You know, it goes right to the water, Houston and Canal.
I think what people here don't realize, that's a very small area. You could walk the area.
It is the 7th Precinct. It's the smallest precinct in New York. And I think it's either 0.7 miles or 1.7 miles in square miles.
Richard Price, is there a task force called the Quality of Life Task Force that drives around the area?
There are guys that, they don't call them Quality of Life, I don't think. But, I mean, there are guys that have that kind of job. See, it all depends what the area standards are. Right now, that place has gone from the most dangerous precinct in the city, it was just a heroin market, to one of the safest. But if you're a precinct commander, you have to give in your numbers at the end of the month to One Police Plaza. Because you have like a pretty tame area, it's going to look like you're not doing anything. So sometimes they go out, you know, just to keep everybody honest and to keep, you know, the precinct commander looking like he's busy. You know, and they'll provoke arrests or, you know, they'll stop cars on spec, you know. But they wouldn't do that in a high crime area. They wouldn't have time to do that.
You went down there to the Lower East Side and you kind of soaked up the scene for a year, year and a half?
Yeah, I went in and out there. It's not like I just sort of, you know, pitched a tent and put pith helmet on.
But where do you live
now? I just hung out. I live like about 20 blocks north of Houston Street.
Okay.
You know, I could walk to work, you know, so to speak. Periodically, I'd go down there, and I made my connections in the police department and in the business world, in the social work world. And, you know, I'd come down and I'd hook up with people. You know, it wasn't like I moved to Africa.
Well, I mean, you're only walking a few blocks.
Yeah, or taking a cab.
Because if
you can't get there with $10 worth of cab, it's not worth going. I never went down with an agenda. I said, maybe today I'm going to hang out with the detective squad.
Right.
They'll have me. Or maybe today I'm going to go to a manager's meeting at Schiller's Liquor Bar. You know, they're going to allow me into the meeting so I can just hear what they talk about.
And Schiller's Liquor Bar is the prototype for Cafe Berkman.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of an amazing place. You know, it's Keith McNally restaurant. Keith McNally's is this remarkable restaurateur. I mean, and he's a great prop master. He knows how to take an old, crummy-looking pharmacy and convert it into a restaurant that looks like it's been there for 100 years. It's created as opposed to, like, a found object. McNally made this great stage set that, even though I know that all this stuff was found in warehouses in Jersey, all these desilvered mirrors, I still have to tell myself that every time I go in there.
Because it feels like an old place.
Yeah, but, I mean, he could do the same thing, you know, make a French bistro in the meatpacking district that looks like, you know, it hosted Gestapo officers in World War II before the partisans came in. And, you know, that place is something out of nothing, too. It's like he's just got a genius for atmosphere.
What this all brings up is the mix of the upscale bohemian watering holes and upscale restaurants with poor people, with people from the projects, with Chinese immigrants trying to keep little stores open. It's a strange mix.
Well, what happens, one of the premises of the book is real estate is violence, that you can't change a neighborhood without shifting tectonic plates and uprooting people. The funny thing is, on the Lower East Side, of all the different worlds down there, the people really don't ever acknowledge each other. It's not like they're at war. It's like the Chinese really don't notice the MFAs. The MFAs really don't notice the black and Hispanic kids. The black and Hispanic kids really don't notice the Orthodox Jews. The Orthodox Jews don't really notice the Chinese. People are just occupying the same physical space as if there's nobody but themselves. Except every once in a while, there'll be a clash. And that'll be 3 o'clock in the morning, two kids from the projects will decide to go to Zagat Street and brace, you know, two kids from the Midwest who are bar hopping, flash a gun, get all their money, go off and get Chinese food. Except that the kids that they're bracing, A, are not street smart. They've never had a gun put in their face. But C, probably drunk. D, one of them's going to do the right thing, be scared, and just hand out, go all Desmond Morris on it, you know, do all the right body language to survive. But one kid might think he's in a movie. and might make a step towards the gun or say something, and the kid with the gun can't believe that this kid is going Steve McQueen on him. A trigger's going to be pulled, a life is going to be taken, there's going to be 5 days of headlines because the news, their favorite victim is like a young aspiring artist come to New York with stars in their eyes and has only found the cold, dead sidewalk of New York. It sells like crazy. And the media is the tail that wags the police dog. Anything that gets ink is going to get action. That's what the book is basically centered on, a homicide like that.
Apparently, you weren't sure where you were going to take it until there was a late-night fatality similar to that?
Well, there was. In the midst of my doing what I was doing, I was thinking about an incident just like that. You know, it was a robbery turned homicide that happened about 2001, 2002. I was already writing about that. In the middle of that, it happened again where this woman, Nicole Dufresne, was an actress and a waitress, and her boyfriend was pistol-whipped, and she sort of like really physically confronted the kid with the gun and was killed. The point is, things like this will happen. But, you know, for 5 days, everybody's freaked out. And day six, it's like people just keep doing what they were always doing.
There's a moment where it becomes clear the book is taking place in 2003.
I was looking for a time in the past where things were still in flux a little more. Now, in 2008... the Lower East Side, for all intents and purposes, is a done deal. It's a fact. Real estate's going through the roof. There are titanic gaping holes in the sidewalk where there used to be a tenement, and a 15-story blue diamond glass thing is going to shoot up and screw up everything. You know, it was going, but it wasn't completely gone.
You're listening to an interview with Richard Price, whose latest novel is Lush Life. You have two main characters. Oh, there are several main characters, but two primary point of view characters. One is a guy named Eric Cash, who you described as, he's me if what has been hadn't been.
To me, he's like the ghost of Christmas future if you didn't play your cards right. You know, the whole thing about the Lower East Side is that, you know, for these kids that come from all over, it's like this creative playground, coffee house laptoping and music and bars, and everybody's got a shaved head and the tattoos. And, you know, it's a real, so you get a real sense of community. And if it was 1974 or 73 when I just started writing, I would have crawled on broken glass to go get to the Lower East Side and live. I mean, that would be my idea of heaven. The thing is, Eric Cash did come down there in the 1990s, and he was an aspiring actor and an aspiring screenwriter, I guess. And when you think you're going to live forever in your early 20s, you know, you don't mind taking jobs that you feel are beneath you, like, you know, being a waitress or a bartender, because you know you're going places. You know, in 10 years now, you're going to win the Pulitzer Prize or right. Walk the red carpet at the Oscars or, you know, make your first billion as an entrepreneur. But what happened with Eric is that he's been down there for a real long time, and now he's 35, and all the hyphens after maitre d' have fallen off. And he realizes he's just a maitre d'. The problem and the torment for him is that he's perpetually surrounded by kids who are 22, like he used to be. And they all think they're going to live forever, and they all think they're going to make it, and there's no reason why they wouldn't. It's agony for him, you know, because down there, it's like 35, it's like 65.
And there's another character, Matty Clark, and he's your cop. I mean, there's a certain sense where he's your cop who's seen it all, who's drunk too much, who's divorced, and yet at the same time, he's an original character, too.
You're required by law, if you write about a detective, he has to be divorced. You can get fined by the Writers Guild if you make a detective that's happily married. And by law, too, he's either got to be a drunk or an ex-drunk. So, I mean, I just didn't want to get fined. I sort of modeled him on a friend of mine who was a detective down in that area, and just in terms of his virtues and his personality. But, I mean, he's pretty much made out of whole cloth. But the Lower East Side is so different than any other area. When, like, a crime is committed down there, no one thinks to look north of 14th Street, which is about 10 blocks away. They're only thinking it's either local kids or kids from Brooklyn who took advantage of the subway, to hop on, hop off subway, because people above 14th Street, the Lower East Side is too geographically complicated for like a, you know, a quick mugging. You don't know how to get the hell out of there. There's no grid.
You've also got a character, Yolanda, who is his partner in the search for the killer. She reminded me a little of Kima from The Wire.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought of that. She's very aggressive. I mean, she's a Puerto Rican detective first grade. She was modeled on this woman who was a Puerto Rican detective first grade in homicide and is a legendary interrogator. And her style is sort of based on making herself the big sister that these alligators never had, or the mother or the girlfriend that these kids never had. And she basically winds up getting fan letters from all the jails around New York State. Yo, I thought you said you were going to come visit me. She's, you know, it's big eyes that can, like, tear up on cue. You know, it's none of this hard cop stuff.
There's a 75-page, something like that, set piece fairly early on in the book where Maddie Clark and Yolanda grill Eric about the crime. First of all, from the perspective of a reader, I haven't read a great interrogation scene like that since a couple of John Le Carré books.
Well, look, if it's 75 pages, it better be great.
How close is that to what you witnessed?
I didn't really witness anything. I mean, you know, I talked to the guys and drips and jabs. Every once in a while, I'd be there, and there'd be some real lowball kind of, like, interrogation going on. Like, nobody really cared, a purse snatcher or, you know, somebody who pulled a gun on somebody but didn't fire it. And they said, well, you know, come in, we'll introduce you. We'll say you're a retired inspector, which I always felt like, do I really look that old? Can I just be an inspector? And they said, no, man, you're retired.
Did you talk to anybody who had been interrogated?
No. I just think people walk around, you know, feeling so bad about so many things on a subliminal level that when somebody actually gives you a formal constructed stage to plead guilty, I mean, you don't even know what you're pleading guilty to, you know, and that's bad in both ways because the cops, well, they will pick up that you're evasive and you're inconsistent and you're lying. And as far as they're concerned, if you're lying, you're guilty. Now, Eric, his crime literally at that moment was he got scared to death and he ran away and he didn't call 911 and he was ashamed. He's ashamed of his own behavior. So he started lying to the cops. Well, I called 911 and they know he didn't. And they said, well, look, we got him. And the pressure because of the media, lock him up, you know, like sew it up, you know, pull the plug. Come on, come on, come on, come on. You know, we don't want a bad headline again. The mayor's going to yell at the police commissioner who's going to yell at me and I'm going to yell at you. Get it wrapped.
Well, when you're writing this, okay, you've got your characters. How set in stone in your head are these people when you sit down to write?
You know what? Before you start writing, you envision characters, and they're going to be a certain way. But there's something about the physical act of committing to creating and, you know, starting to type. It's like you finally slip on the skin of the character, and you get to know them in a very different way that you couldn't anticipate just in your outline or in your hypothetical thing. They're going to do different things. It's not a mystical thing. It's not all of a sudden I'm going to realize, well, this guy really needs to be a transvestite when I thought he was going to be like an ex-high school football star.
Right.
You know, but they're going to behave in a little bit different way. And you don't know that until you got to jump in the water and get wet before you know your characters. Really.
Well, at the time when you started writing Maddie, did you know that he had the two sons from upstate New York who were kind of losers?
Yeah, sort of. But even then, I didn't know what their relationship was going to be like until I gave it to them. You know, it's really strange. There's just a physical act of writing. All bets are off.
So the moment that the first phone conversation with his ex-wife, that's in a way the first time you discover who she is and what their relationship
is?
Yeah,
basically I had a vague notion that it was going to be kind of testy.
Right.
And, you know, they were a little chronically pissed at each other. But until I started putting words in people's mouths, sometimes like those scenes are like improv. Like I sort of know where I want to end up, but I'm not sure how I'm going to get to that destination. It's like scat singing or bebop, you know.
Right.
It's like I'm going to wing it, and I'll discover things in the winging process.
Well, when David Simon talks about The Wire, he seems to have it so down, like these are the big pictures that I am looking for. For instance, in the final season, he goes, you know, doesn't anybody get the fact that the papers get everything wrong, as if, you know, this is some kind of overarching view of societal, you know, the ruins of society. When you're writing a book like this, you're not thinking of that.
No, basically all I'm doing is I'm not coming down on the cops. I'm not supporting the cops. I'm going to bear witness to what I see, the quality of life when they make these sort of like two-bit right. chicken arrests. I'm not going to say this is harassment, this is racial profiling. I'm going to just be as faithful in a creative way as I can to the spirit of what I really witnessed, and I'm going to let you come to your conclusion about it.
When you do come to conclusions about it, I mean, which are maybe more obvious in books like Freedomland or Clockers than in this particular book, how do you keep those conclusions out?
I just feel like they're unnecessary. It's like somebody can say, I mean, we're talking about negativity of character. You know, you could tell somebody, look, this guy's a bad guy. Or you could just show them do their thing. But look, you know, if 10 people looked out a window and they saw a fight between a man and a woman, and the man slapped the woman, or the woman slapped the man, and you asked those 10 people to sit down and write what they just saw, you would get 10 entirely different interpretations. I'm going to take a photo of what I saw, and you just interpret it whatever way you want.
Well, the advantage, of course, for you is that if the embellishment comes up and you don't quite remember, you just fill in the details yourself.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm allowed to make things up. It's called fiction. You know, I don't get in trouble for that. You know, I get a gold star for that.
When talking about race in America, and you see the pundits go on about, say, you know, the Reverend Wright and Obama, what goes through your mind?
I don't know. I mean, this political thing, it's like, you know, the higher you are, the more people that are around you, and the more likely you're going to have some jerk or some very bright person who's going to say something incredibly stupid. And they spend so much time, oh, your guy just said that. Oh, but your guy just said that. Oops, oops, oops. You know, it's all baloney. You know, you're not responsible. So you got a guy talking about, you know, AIDS is a conspiracy, you know. He's not running for office. Obama is. You cannot run for a huge office without inviting all kinds of people into your camp. You just need their support. You're not going to get elected.
When I've talked to African Americans about Obama, their eyes light up.
The thing I like about Obama, I don't care about how pretty a speechmaker he is. I mean, Hitler gave great speeches, too, you know. And I don't care about how much experience he had. George Bush certainly has a lot of experience. How, you know, what does that tell you? I just, you know, it's this desperate thing you feel like, I want to roll the dice on somebody brand new. Everything sucks so bad now. I don't want another Clinton, you know, a Bush, a Clinton. And, you know, is it going to be both Clintons in there? You know, is he going to be in her ear the whole time? You know, you roll the dice on a new guy who sort of sounds good. I know it doesn't mean anything. I mean, Kennedy had all the charisma in the world and couldn't get anything done. LBJ, you know, the ugly Texan. I mean, he got all that stuff done.
Right.
It's not about surface. You know, wow, I'm so inspired by that speech. The speech isn't getting anything through Congress. I'm voting for Obama just because I don't want a Clinton and I don't want a Bush. I'd vote for a fire hydrant before I'd vote for a Republican.
Richard Price, I guess you mentioned this, but it just came up again in my brain, which is this bizarre racial divide. When the cops go to talk to the Hispanic people, there's some connection between them and the blacks, but there's no connection whatsoever between those sequences, which are taking place feet away, almost literally, from Berkman's and the white people. None. It just doesn't exist.
There's an incredible obliviousness on everybody's part.
The
only people that would react to gentrification, in fact, would be the original gentrifiers, the white pioneers that came in the 70s, and now it's like Columbus discovering America. Oh, really? Tell that to the Indians. I mean, they must be so happy to finally have been discovered. You know, but you got these white pioneers, and now the neighborhood is noisy. They got in there on the cheap, and they might own their place now. And
that's the guy across the street from Berkman's who's complaining.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I remember this neighborhood, you know, back in the 80s when it was like a heroin market. You know, you could get some peace and quiet. You know, now you got everybody going out for smokes, puking everywhere, whistling for cabs. And, you know, but, I mean, these are the people that complain. It's like the other white guys, the Hispanics, the Chinese, the people who get jobs out of this stuff. They don't really care. And it's a job. The original gentry are the ones that are up in arms.
There's another character, Billy Marcus, William Marcus, the father of the murdered guy. He plays a huge role in the book, and I guess you wanted to tell the story of what happens to the families as well.
Well, see, this is why, I mean, every once in a while somebody tries to cubbyhole me as a crime writer, and I'm not. You know, I don't really care. If I could tell you on the cover who did it, I would. You know, and you find there's no real mystery about who did it. You find out pretty fast. I'm much more interested in the fallout you know, how this affects the chain reaction. A butterfly flaps its wings in Madagascar and you get a tidal wave in Antarctica or something like that. You know, a shot is fired and this is how the ripple effect, how it affects all these lives. And Billy Marcus is the father of this kid, Ike, who's killed. And he lives in Riverdale, which is sort of like, you know, a semi-affluent area of the Bronx. And he becomes like a ghost. He goes down to the Lower East Side and he's looking for his son who's no longer there. And he just becomes a haunted figure. And he's out of his mind, too. I mean, the book takes place in about 2 weeks. So if somebody lost a child, they're not going to evolve. I mean, if anything, they're just going to deteriorate. So basically, I have to write about a person who's mentally ill, hopefully temporary. I don't get enough chance to miraculously cure him or have him find any peace. You know, and he gets in everybody's way. He's, you know, in a relationship builds between this detective and this grieving father, because when the police bureaucracy shut down this case in terms of nobody talks to the police, we're never going to solve this, it's an embarrassment, let it die a pressless death. The cop is pissed, and he starts using the father as a guided missile to get more publicity. It makes the father donate more money to the arrest fund and basically start blackmailing the cop's higher-ups into getting back on it. And so it's about this strange partnership.
Richard Price, you've talked about having had this huge manuscript. I think someone once said it was 1,000 pages long or something for this book, two novels. What's the story behind that?
Well, the problem was when I came down to the Lower East Side, there was so much going on, and I have this thing, as long as I witness something, it's in. You know, and when my editor finally got a look at this manuscript, I mean, it's like there's a novel somewhere inside here, but we're gonna in order to get it out, it's like gonna be like taking a calf out of a cow. I lost about 300 pages.
What did you primarily lose?
Most of the stuff that I lost was stuff about the family of the dead kid, fallout on the father. You know, the father really goes around a bend in the pages that I had taken out, and my editor convinced me that. We get the father very quick. We get his grief very quick. And once you get something, you don't need 100 pages of more of the same. You know, you hammered it home. And I think that's a big difference between this book and some of my earlier books, is that I finally started throwing things away. I finally started the streamlining process. I don't know if it's a matter of confidence or coaching, but I finally realized you don't have to say things 8 different ways to get your point across. I think a lot of writers, they feel... maybe younger writers, but I've always had this problem. I feel I'm concerned that somebody's not going to get it. So I just pile on the details. And, you know, as you get older, you tend to streamline your life. And I think when writers get older, they just feel like, why write it 8 times, you know?
So to that degree, and maybe other degrees, your work on all of these screenplays and your work on The Wire changes the way you actually write.
No, they don't have any impact at all.
But in terms of not content, but in terms of pacing?
No, they don't. In fact, I get in trouble with my screenplays because I'm really at heart a novelist and I'm not a visual artist. So I tend to rely heavily on dialogue. And no matter how good the dialogue might be, movies are about speed, you know. So I don't think anything of my novel writing background helped me as a screenwriter. And certainly my screenwriting background doesn't carry over to novels, even though it looks like this book is like cut in a certain way, like it's almost like film edited. It just turned out that way. I mean, if it came out of screenwriting, I'm not aware of it.
Well, you just said a few moments ago that, you know, that your work in doing screenwriting made you understand you could take the Billy Marcus stuff out.
No, what I meant was my work in screenwriting, the most valuable thing I've learned in screenwriting is that I don't have to personally experience everything to be able to write about it. I can go out and master stuff. In terms of like rhythm and momentum and tone, novels negatively affect screenwriting. Screenwriting has no impact on my novels. I mean, my first draft as a novel, like I said, was like 1,000 pages. That's not very smart.
The thing is that you walk in and now you know, I'm going to shape this thing. I'm going to do something with it. I'm going to create something. And you got to kind of have a form to work with.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think all I can say is I finally went from the philosophy that more is more to less is more.
And you still got a 450-page novel.
Yeah, it reads like 430 pages, so, you know, it's a bullet.
And you always knew, I guess, from the beginning that it would open on virtually on the killing and it would close virtually on the end of the story.
You know, I don't remember, but I mean, the hardest thing in the world for me is, what's your first sentence? You know, okay, no, you're out. You went out and you're in the field. You hung out. And at some point, you know, you got to go home and you got to take all that osmosis and you got to say it was a dark and stormy night. And getting that first sentence down is the hardest thing in the world.
I was absolutely blown away by the prologue, the quality of life story that begins it. It was like, just puts you right down, and you don't even have the story. You don't even have the novel
yeah,
yet.
Yeah, it was like an overture.
Yeah.
You know, I really wanted to, like, introduce the neighborhood with this, from these, like, Flying Dutchmen, you know, just restlessly prowling. But, you know, that just sort of happened. That's what I mean. So when you sit down and you actually, you know, bring ink to paper, you know, you got to let go a little, and you hopefully you'll surprise yourself in a good way. But that was almost like a surprise. I wanted to perpetually go back to that prowling car, almost like as a Greek chorus, or, you know, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and Lugo and Schmidt, you know.
And some of the names of these people, I noticed a few names that seemed to come from the mystery field, a couple of baseball players in there. Well, Lugo.
Oh, no, I was just making up names. Sometimes, you know, you hit a name that has a resonance that you didn't even mean. Like, I had this kid in the quality of life thing. I mean, the kid who's getting locked up says, oh, my uncle's a detective. What are you doing? I say, what's his name? And I said, Narciso Rodriguez. And then somebody later told me that's a big fashion designer, Narciso Rodriguez. I was just trying to think of a sort of a strange Hispanic first name, you know. Well, I remember in The Wanderers, I used one guy's real name for one sentence in the book, and next thing I know, I was getting a letter from his lawyer. I didn't even have him do anything in the book.
Richard Price, now that you've written Lush Life, now that The Wire is over, beyond working on the occasional screenplay, have you begun gathering your thoughts and your
about research? Another novel?
Yeah.
No, it takes me as long to figure out what I want to write as it does to actually write it, and I owe this script. I'm going to finish. I mean, the script, I had the writer's strike and it ran into the book tour, so that's been frustrating. But and then I'm going to be doing a pilot for FX that sort of takes place on the Lower East Side.
You've titled your book Lush Life, which has actually been used for other book titles based on the Billy Strayhorn song. Why did you choose
same
that?
Same publisher,
too.
Yeah, the biography of Billy Strayhorn, Lush Life.
What prompted you to use Lush Life?
I just like I never looked at the lyrics of the song, but the phrase, it just, you know, I was writing about an area where there's such an abundance of different universes and cultures, and the irony of the fact that it all centers around a death. And I just like the irony of the phrase Lush Life, and so I gave it in, but then I finally went and looked at the lyrics, and it was about a bunch of old ladies getting hammered in a Third Avenue bar in the middle of the day.
Well, Freedom Land, I remember Freedom Land in the Bronx, and you said it in Jersey.
I was just intent on using Freedom Land in the title, and the publisher didn't like it, but, you know. But, yeah, I had to make a mini Freedom Land, like a ripoff of the original Freedom Land. I had to, you know, justify.
One final question. What did you think of the film versions of Clockers and Freedom Land?
I kind of flipped out on both. Clockers, I kind of had a bad reaction because, you know, when you write a novel, I wrote the script. I spent years on a script with Scorsese. And when I saw the movie, you know, you go in there and you're expecting to see a novel up there. And, I mean, that's the worst thing that the director can try to do is try to, like, be too slavish to the source material. And he tore it apart, and he made a movie out of it, which is what he should have done. And he's a great stylist. I thought that the writing, you know, it was a little more sentimental than I would have had. But, you know, I think there's some really good stuff in it, you know. Freedom Land was kind of difficult. I mean, you had a lot of actors and a lot of good actors and good scenes, and it's, I don't know.
Do you expect to work on a screenplay for Lush Life?
Yeah, I'm supposed to. We sold a book to Scott Rudin, who's I've known since he was a teenager when he was the casting director on The Wanderers. It's like a high school dropout. So, yeah, and he sort of collects me. People tend to want me to do the books because they also write screenplays, and my books are not about stuff that's normally filmed. I mean, you know, you got a 600-page book about crack and housing projects and cops. You know, you're not going to look to the guy who did Rain Man.
Right.
You know, it's like, well, who can do this? Oh, the novelist happens to be a screenwriter. Well, okay, we'll buy the book if you come along. And in a way, you don't really want to do it because you just spent 3 years doing Lush Life or Freedom Land, and now you got to say you just did Freedom Land for 3 years. Now you got to do Lotar Freedom Land or Freedom Land Light, you know. But I think there's ways to approach this book that would be interesting.
I think this book, because it gets into the psychological effects of the characters so deeply, and the plot itself, the story, is in a way very brief. There's plenty of room to work with what's there.
Yeah, I mean, I like the notion of like two ships passing in the night, like an old Altman movie,
right?
Or I guess the most recent successful version of that was Crash. You know, not where you're going backwards in time, but you know, people that are main characters who bump into each other and say, "Excuse me," you know, for 2 hours, and their stories are interconnected. You know, the Mexicans do that a lot.
Right. Also, The Wire did that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, The Wire was so laid out. I mean, The Wire was like the world's longest novel, you know.
You've been listening to an interview with Richard Price, whose latest novel is Lush Life. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.